Hi, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Shauna. I attended Faith Lutheran back in 2017, 2018, I think a little bit of 2019, and you all completely changed my life. I got baptized there, I became a member of the church, and I was inspired to go to seminary. I ended up at Yale Divinity School, where I completed about two-thirds of my first year before the pandemic began, at which point I went home to Missouri and completed my first year and my second year there, remotely. But I'm really looking forward to getting back to New Haven in the fall, God willing, to complete my third and final year. And right now, I'm in Kansas City, where I'm doing my chaplaincy internship at St. Luke's Hospital, and I'm really loving it. So thank you for having me here today. I'm really glad to be with you. The Lord be with you. When I was 12, my parents sat me down on the couch with them on either side of me and very gently told me that my dad would be moving to a town about 30 minutes away from ours. I remember asking him quite sincerely, "Oh, so you've got a big work project to do over there?" Before they elaborated that no, he would be moving out because they were getting divorced. I flung both their hands from off my shoulders and stormed to my room, where I would stay until the next morning. And over the course of the night, in my head, I rearranged everything I thought I knew about my family structure as a means of trying to make sense of it all. My mom was the one who chose to stay with me, who cared about me. My dad was the clear villain, the one who had acted unforgivably, the one who left. And so I didn't utter more than a few words to my dad for over a year, finding a strangely comforting satisfaction in having delineated the fault line that set me and my mom surely on the side of good and right, and isolated him over on the side of bad. I found what felt like safety in this utterly disorienting experience by creating a story for myself which didn't demand of me the exhausting task of holding space not only for my dad's messy complexity, but for my mom's or for mine. As I've been reading and reflecting on our gospel passage over the past few weeks, I've been struck by just how continually tempted I am to make sense of this story, this horrifying tale, by sussing out who is really most at fault and why. Here at this sordid feast, we as readers are served a downright cornucopia of naughty behavior. Harry kicks it off with the fact that he's committed this big Levitical no-no of marrying his brother's wife, and it's his wife, Herodias, who very purposefully orchestrates the decapitation of John the Baptist because he's been calling them both out on their illegal marriage, and then Herodias' daughter, who in our text is called Herodias as well, but who I'm going to be calling Salome in accordance with the historian Josephus naming, so as to avoid confusion. So Herodias' daughter Salome, in reward for performing what was apparently the best dance of all time, is offered by Herod whatever her heart desires, up to half the kingdom, in response to which she unhesitatingly obeys her mother's direction to ask for John the Baptist's head on a platter, no less. And then Herod's a dummy again when he decides that his reputation is more important than John the Baptist's life, and that for appearance's sake, he must follow through on the oath he made to Salome, even though he really kind of liked the guy, but you know, what can you do? Selfish, vain, thoughtless, cruel actions abound in this story. But not everyone's depicted as equally immoral. And to speak for myself, I was quick here to design my own hierarchy for this lot where, at least for me, here's Salome, who first of all is an actual child and also is just quite the puppet being manipulated by her mother, even if she is the one who directly ordered John the Baptist's beheading. And then Herod, too, is given some humanity by being reluctant and conflicted and deeply grieved over having to uphold his end of the bargain by decapitating John the Baptist. But then Herodias, on the other hand, her sole purpose here is as this vengeful, wrathful murder mastermind. There are no redeeming qualities. And she could have, I don't know, kept John the Baptist in prison for forever, or exiled him from the kingdom, or demanded that he publicly revoke his statement, but no. She is rage personified, fuming, claws for nails monster, intent on nothing less than annihilation of someone who we and the disciples love and appreciate dearly. There's not the subtlest hint of inner conflict, regret, let alone compassion or kindness in Herodias, and that is, in the world of stories, traditionally what makes a villain a villain. Furthermore, the purpose of the villain is generally to teach us how not to be. Good people, this story might seem to remind us, aren't like Herodias. Chosen people aren't like Herodias. And it makes for a great story. Don't you just love the satisfaction of a tale where the good guy is good to the end and the villain is truly vile to the core? I mean, just look at many of the most timeless stories that form us. Brothers Grimm, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Wizard of Oz, any story with monsters, pretty much. I love escaping into a make-believe world where I don't have to use my energy to try to discern the humanity of those who horrify or scare me. But as we are beings who live our lives by stories, it's all too understandable that these black and white moral dichotomies often seep into and frame our personal lives. And whether consciously or otherwise, we try to parse out oppositional valors and villainies in our own worlds as well. Real life is never so simple. Nonetheless, in the years after my dad moved out, I continued to keep my distance, clinging to my good parent, bad parent narrative, which almost seemed to function as this compass, keeping me oriented in an otherwise dizzyingly disorienting period of my life. Even so, my dad persisted in doing his best to be my dad, and with patience and love in the face of my shunning. And then, when he was diagnosed with cancer and grew dangerously ill, I still didn't engage. It was like, after all this time of training my brain to perceive him in this way, those neuromuscles had grown too large and too powerful to accommodate any idea of my dad's humanity. To let him in would mean the shattering of my painstakingly constructed emotional barricade, which still felt protective. But I also began to experience something else. See, when we try to judge our own rigid delineation of the good and bad in the world around us, our brain can get so practiced, so effective at drawing those lines of judgment, that one day we look up and realize that our own brain has put us on the side of bad. As the realization that I'd been wrong about my dad being a soulless enemy became harder and harder to avoid, it also became harder and harder for me to shake the nagging thought that actually the whole time the bad guy had been me. My shame just kept growing. The memories of all the times I'd been dismissive or rude or cruel formed themselves into a different barricade, and this time, it trapped me inside what was bad and left the rest of the world out. My shame also convinced me that atonement would be far more excruciating than the safety of its isolating walls. And so while it was terribly lonely and painful, I also felt like it was the only option. So when I read about Herodias in our gospel passage today, I remember that there was a time when I think I kind of felt like her. When she too suffered the tragedy of being unable to find her way out of the desperate barricade she'd built around herself for protection. This barricade of lies, which may have at first reassured her, made her feel safe, and enabled her to do terrible but self-protective things, before she inevitably realized that it wasn't protecting her at all, but trapping her inside her own cruel actions, inside the belief that she was the worst thing she had done. But another reason I really want to take a look at the absence of any hint of humanity in Herodias is because I worry that it hinders us from finding any good news in this story. I mean, there are more morals in this story than we know what to do with. For one, that you should just keep your nose out of other people's business if you want your head to stay attached to your body. No, but in all seriousness, we have don't do something you know is wrong because you feel pressured by the crowd, and don't thoughtlessly obey orders even if they come from your mother, or hopefully one that isn't too applicable for most people of don't behead someone who calls you out, or more benignly, like don't attack someone who points out a mistake you've made. These are all great reminders, but they are morals. And the gospel is not primarily a moral text. It is first and foremost the good news. And there's a big difference. Where the moral of a story tells us that life will be better if you behave differently, the good news tells us that no matter how poor or unforgivable your behavior has been, you are a beloved child of God. And where morals imply that you must try harder in order to be good, the good news tells us that there's no effort that can attain the grace of being worthy, because the goodness of God is the unassailable, untouchable core of each and every one of us, in spite of our best efforts to prove it or to deny it. And over again, as I have prepared for this sermon, I keep encountering reflections on this passage which conclude that there just is no good news in this story. This is just one of the Bible's terrible texts, and the best we can do is to juxtapose the feast story, this feast story, with the feast of the loaves and fishes that immediately follows it in the text. And in a certain sense, these reflections are right. There's no good news in this passage because Jesus is the good news, and he's off elsewhere, miles away. But maybe it's just the contrarian in me. I just want so badly to believe that this story, even with all its tragedy, somehow offers direct access to the good news. And so I wonder whether it's too far-fetched to find the good news of this story, not in what the story says, but in how we as readers participate in it. And here's what I mean by that. One way to experience this story is as a work of entertaining literature, with all its suspense and shock and horror and sleazy glitz and debauchery, you know, just to delight in the delicious satisfaction of judging the character of everyone involved here. But perhaps there's a more participatory way to live in this story when we read it. Isn't it interesting that this passage, the only passage without Jesus in the entire Gospel of Mark, comes directly after Jesus sends out his disciples to do God's work in the world without him by their side? Isn't that kind of striking? Of all the places for Jesus to excuse himself, it's the passage where we've just been shown what the disciples did when he sent them out. Could it be that we, the readers, are being invited to imagine ourselves as disciples in this space? What happens when our task here is to practice doing what the disciples have been doing in how we read this passage with our imaginations and with our discussions? What would that look like? For one, it would look like practicing believing, even if only by faith, that at the core of each of these characters, beyond their failings and their fear-based behavior, is a true goodness that cannot be harmed no matter how abhorrent their behavior, no matter how heartlessly they may be depicted. It would look like believing that each of these people are beloved, so incredibly beloved by God, even when there is no Jesus here or any of his disciples here to remind us of that. It might look like reading this passage alongside King David's in 2 Samuel chapter 11, when he sees a woman named Bathsheba bathing, and upon deciding he must have her, arranges the gruesome death of her husband, Uriah the Hittite, so that he can marry her. King David, who is anointed and chosen by God, is also someone in the Bible who brutally orchestrates the slaughter of the man who stands in the way of him being married to someone he desires. And so he and Herodias commit what is in many ways the exact same horrifying crime. And if we know that David is chosen, beloved, even after he does this, what does that do to our perception of Herodias? I think there's so much good news between the lines of this horrible story, that even when Jesus seems absent, he's always doing work through our eyes, through our hands, of making all things new, of crumbling our good, bad barricades, no matter whether we put ourselves among the righteous or the wretched, reminding us again and again that we are all in the same boat by God's grace, that we're all sinner and saint, no matter how hard we try to cling to one or the other. And so it was by grace that in time, as we went on and began to understand that my very normal reaction to my parents' divorce wasn't actually the truth, that my dad and I began to reconcile, to talk, to listen, to hug, to laugh, to grieve, to get to know one another again. We both had to learn to practice forgiveness in order to be able to live in relationship with the good and the bad in the other, as well as in ourselves. And our reconciliation, rather than an act by which we both landed on the same side of good, happened because we learned and continue to always relearn how to accept our bothness, even as we appreciate it as what brings us together when we tell the truth about it. The good news is that we are never stuck in the exhausting pain of judging what is good and bad for ourselves, because Jesus will never stop inviting us back into discipleship, where through faith we may see and uphold and appreciate the heart of God in even the most apparently terrible people. The good news is that, as today's psalm reminds us, the earth is the Lord's and all who are in it. And thanks be to God, any wall we ever attempt to build as a means of denying that, whether it condemns others or ourselves, will surely crumble under the power of God's love. Amen.